the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Virginia Elvino-Young in for Kevin Gavin. Coming up, this week marked the launch of a new podcast. Schooled promises to give the inside story on public education. And we'll talk to two local photographers about how their outlets are documenting the opioid crisis. But first, new research on football-induced brain trauma was released just days before your Pittsburgh Steelers returned to La Trobe for training camp. We'll discuss what to expect from the team this year. With us today is Liz Bloom from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Sports reporter Lauren Kirschman with Penn Live is here. Great to have you, Lauren, as well.
Great to be here.
And Ben Schmidt with the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are back at training camp. So, Liz, I understand you're a diehard Patriots fan, though, so let's just try to keep it civil here, if we could.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. If you've got a question, comment, something snarky to say to Liz, the Patriots fan, we'd love to get you in on the conversation.
Always welcome, yeah.
Yeah, bring it. Tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, it's day two, St. Vincent College, where thousands of fans greeted the team. What do we know about the vibe out there? How are these things feel on day two?
Well, I think at the start of any season, before the season actually gets started, there's just such a feeling of optimism around any team because nothing has happened yet and anything can happen. So I think especially with this Steelers team that has such high expectations coming in this year, for fans to get out there and get a chance to get up close and personal with these players for perhaps the only time this season and really see these guys and what they can do. I just really think the start of training camp is probably the most optimistic fans will be all year, and I think that's the vibe you get when you're out there.
Yeah, I mean, why is there so much to look forward to this year?
Well, I was going to say that there is a lot of optimism, but I also think the main question is, can they beat the Patriots?
They really never do.
And even when they get all the way to the AFC Championship game, that seems to be the team that's in the way. Haven't got over that hump yet.
They have. I mean, in 2016, the Steelers did make it to the playoffs for, I think, the third straight year. Can they break out this year and take it all?
I mean, I think every year the question, especially in recent years, has been about the defense. I mean, they're switching to a man-to-man defense specifically because of what happened in last year's AFC Championship game. There's also the question of injuries. Can Le'Veon Bell make it deep into the playoffs this year? Can they rely on Martavis Bryant to stay out of trouble? These are sort of the questions, you know, on paper, this offense should be absolutely incredible. But when push comes to shove, what will actually happen once you get deep into the playoffs?
I mean, speaking of Bell, though, that's a big if for the team just right now. He didn't report yesterday for the first day. He does have, I think, a $12 million contract that's on the table. But is this absence just about avoiding injury before the start of the season? Is it about holding out for a better or a longer term deal, maybe?
I think for Bell, I mean, he said that he kind of wants to reset the running back market, kind of believes that running backs aren't getting paid what they should. So that's why he turned down such a lucrative long-term contract. He wanted more. So I think for him, it's about that. It's about kind of getting running backs paid what he thinks they should be paid and what he thinks he should be paid.
Well, what's interesting is Antonio Brown just recently, who is the highest paid wide receiver in the league himself, he recently signed his own long-term deal. He took to social media and was given a little nudge to Bell saying, hey, we need you on the field right now. Get this signed and taken care of.
And I think Bell will eventually report and play. He kind of has to get the one-year $12 million contract. If he doesn't, he doesn't get that money, and he needs that money. I think the thing is he wants something more than a one-year deal. He wants four or five years.
What are we thinking from Big Ben this year? We've got Roethlisberger out there. They did use a draft pick earlier on to pick up Joshua Dobbs, but is there any difference in his spirit or approach expected this year now that he's sort of nearing the end of his long-term contract?
I think that there is a bit of urgency among Steelers fans. There are only so many franchise quarterbacks that you can really rely on that are really generational talents like Ben Roethlisberger. He alluded last season to the fact that he may be considering retirement. I don't think anybody took that particular threat too seriously, but I think it was kind of a nod to folks that, hey, this is kind of a now or never situation. We only have 1 to 3 seasons maybe to really make this happen.
Yeah, I think even for the broader group, like just even beyond Roethlisberger, when you have this group of Bell and Brown and Roethlisberger all together, it's that sense of urgency, like Liz said, of how long are these players going to be together? How many more opportunities going to come along. So I think that's the kind of the feeling heading into this season.
Is that on the fans' side as well, that they're feeling that this is sort of like a golden moment, a confluence, if you will, of players on the field that share those skills?
Yeah, I think there's a window. And, you know, Roethlisberger is 35. So even if he doesn't retire, one more injury could end it, you know, without his choosing. So I think there are some fans that are worried about like that. Are we going to get this done? Are we going to win one more Super Bowl before he retires?
I think in Pittsburgh, anything less than a Super Bowl is kind of, to some extent, a disappointing year. And I think that's certainly the case when you have a generational talent like Ben Roethlisberger. People are saying if he only gets two Super Bowl rings, that will be a disappointment, which is kind of crazy because most quarterbacks would kill for two Super Bowl rings. But nonetheless, I think given the history that this franchise has, people really think it would be a waste not to. I mean, you have the best running back in the league, best wide receiver, one of the best quarterbacks. You know, all of these guys are kind of top three players, and it would be a loss not to sort of end one of these seasons, one of these days, with a Super Bowl ring.
Do you think that those expectations are kind of growing in Pittsburgh because sports team-wide in the city, you've got the Penguins coming off of two back-to-back wins, Pirates not doing too bad, Steelers getting close a couple of times there. Do you think that that's really amping up that higher expectation?
I think there's some of that, but I also think fans are leery of Tom Brady and the Patriots.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, I really do think the Patriots are even on the players' minds this early in the season. I mean, they've already talked about the Patriots, and some people are predicting the Patriots to go undefeated this season.
Sorry.
So I think that, I think that's always kind of looming in the distance there is the Patriots, and how are they going to beat the Patriots?
Thank you for answering on behalf of the entire franchise there.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Well, one thing's for sure, for the first time since 1975, the Steelers this year will enter a season without Dan Rooney, who died in April at age 84. He oversaw six Super Bowl championships, eight AFC titles. What do we expect the impact to be on the team going into the season?
Well, we know that they're going to be wearing Dan Rooney patches on their jerseys this year. I think it's a really nice kind of motivating factor. Not that these teams need additional motivation, but I think whenever there's a nice storyline, you know, you can do something for Dan Rooney or you can do something for somebody. I think that adds a little bit of edge to the team. There's another really good storyline in James Conner's, you know, draft pick by the Steelers this year. He overcame cancer. It's a really amazing story. I think that they have a really nice rookie class this year, and it's cool that they have these sort of outside stories that add interest to the team this year.
Anything else new going into the season? Well, I mean, go ahead. All right, well, switching gears, something that's really weighing heavy on the minds of some of the fans was this updated study that was released just earlier this year in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it found a really, really high percentage, 110 out of 111 brains of deceased NFL football players had CTE, which is a degenerative brain disease, which is linked, some still is not known, but is linked to repeated blows to the head. So we've been hearing about this for a long time. What is new about these findings?
Well, I think the new thing is that number, 110 out of 111. We've been learning about this brain bank where they're looking at the brains of former NFL players. And some people would argue this is no surprise. Everybody expected this. But that number is so large, 110 out of 111, you know, 99%. Some people would say the debate's over. There is a link. And then others would, you know, argue other things.
Yeah, I was going to say the size is certainly a new factor, in addition to which it's a single sport that they're talking about here. You know, when you have a few dozen players that you're talking about, that's one thing. Now you have 110 NFL players out of 202 football players examined in total, and that's just a huge number. That means that of the 1,300 players who have died since BU started studying these brains, at least 9% of them have CTE. And it's fair to say that there's probably a lot more than that because they didn't examine the, you know, other 1,200 brains of former NFL players who've died in that period.
Any weight from you guys given to the idea that there may be some bias involved in the study in terms of the brains that were being studied were coming from families of people who maybe had concerns that their loved ones were being affected by the disease? Could that be a factor?
Well, I think the study authors were pretty open about that. I actually didn't do the interview, but I saw a podcast with one of the study authors, and she said that, you know, these were brains that there were suspicions that there was maybe CTE. But I think overall, still, the number is jarring.
And speaking of that personal family response, Ben, I believe you've spoken with some family members of the participants who were considered in this study.
Yeah, I have. The wife of Ralph Wenzel, who played in the league for 7 years, I think 4 years with the Steelers, she donated his brain early on, and she's been a very strong advocate for looking into CTE. And that was also her response. There's no surprise here, but I'm glad that it's getting the attention. Those are her words.
Liz, Lauren, what does this mean for the NFL itself? They've already contributed quite a bit of funds towards research, but is this going to change anything about how they approach the issue?
I think the answer is probably no. As Ben said, there's no world in which a scientist would design a study like this if they absolutely had other choices. Ideally, when you have a scientific study, you have double blind, you have a control group and that sort of thing, and then you can attempt to try to sort of show some causality. The issue with this is that these are all folks who've already passed away. We don't exactly know what the pathology of this disease is. We don't know how to treat it. We can't diagnose it in the living. And that makes it extremely difficult to say, here is what the NFL absolutely should do. I mean, the answer may be the NFL should ban tackling. But we don't actually know that. And I think that makes it difficult for the NFL to make any real policy changes.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I don't think the NFL is going to make those policy changes unless there is definitive proof. And I don't think that that's going to be something that comes along. There's no way to definitively prove this, at least not right now. And I don't see the NFL taking the steps to do more than it has or make policy changes unless that happens.
Well, it seems kind of like a catch-22 also, right? I mean, they could be funding the research that would give more definitive answers, but then would that affect them negatively as a corporation? So what do we expect there?
Well, the NFL has, in fact, acknowledged the link between CTE and football at this point. In March 2016, their top health guy officially said, yes, we acknowledge that there is a real connection here. I think the thing that isn't clear is what confounding variables are there. Can diet play a role? Can, a history of drug use or any sort of genetic factors play a role? And certainly they could fund that research, and that would help people come up with these solutions. But, it is a catch-22 for them, and it's also a PR issue for them. If it seems like they are kind of preventing research on this front, are people going to say, I'm not going to support the NFL anymore, or I'm not going to let my kid play football? And that's going to be an issue for them down the road, because if there's not good talent, people aren't going to watch the game anymore.
Right. For any of you, has this latest CTE study, has there been any talk among players or fans?
There's definitely been talk among players. Most players seem to be saying that they keep an eye on these things and it's concerning and it's alarming, but they don't necessarily worry about it on a daily basis. A lot of them have said if they could go back, they would still play football and that this wouldn't change the decisions that they've made in their lives. But they do keep an eye on this. I've seen a lot of players saying that this wasn't surprising. It's about what they expected from a study like this. And they just said it's basically risk versus reward. It's deciding if playing this game and doing what you love is worth what might happen to you later on in life. So it's just a personal decision for a lot of them. And it seems like most of them would still play football if they could go back in time and do it again.
I think it's worth remembering that a lot of these players come from pretty down and out backgrounds. For them, football is a real chance to change their lives. They are adults. They're above the age of 18, certainly when they agree to play in the NFL. And they are able to change the lives and change their own lives and change the lives of their families and people around them. I think a really interesting kind of counterexample is the case of John Urschel, who just retired from the Baltimore Ravens, a former Penn State football player. And he decided to retire this week, and reports say part of that was because of the CTE study. He is going to pursue a PhD at MIT in mathematics. I think he'll be okay, but certainly not everybody is a mathematics genius like him, and not everybody has that real obvious alternative. For a lot of these guys, it's all they've been doing their whole lives.
I mean, I'm wondering as well, since a lot of players have made that decision, well, it's worth it even if I know what the possible outcomes are. Is there anything that the fans should be demanding of players or doctors, teams, the NFL, to ensure a sort of like minimum degree of safety for the players that they idolize, not only to ensure their well-being, but to ensure that they're able to keep playing the game?
Well, a cynic would say that fans don't care. They want to be entertained. They want to watch the game, and they enjoy football as it is. But many of these fans are also parents, and I think that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, as far as if you have a child, will you let that child play football? I think that's a very personal decision, and it's hard to ignore the information that's been put out there.
All right, folks. Well, training camp continues through August 20th at St. Vincent College in Latrobe, PA. You folks headed out there?
Yeah, I'll be headed out there at some point to join our Pittsburgh Steelers reporter. I'm not sure when yet, but I'll be out there.
All right. Well, we'll see how it goes, and we'll look out for that reporting as well. Ben Schmidt is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Liz Bloom covers sports and classical music, actually, for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Liz, I think we've had a little side project going for you. If you had to make a fantasy football league using only Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra players, who would your top picks be?
Well, you know, football and classical music, there's a lot of similarities there. This may be a surprise for some of you, but, you know, people love to use sports analogies for classical music. People often talk about the concertmaster, the first violinist of an orchestra, being like the quarterback. Right now, the PSO does not have a full-time concertmaster, so they're missing their franchise quarterback, but they have a music director, their coach, on Manfred Honeck. I think of Cindy Coledo de Almeida, their principal oboist, as kind of the running back. She does a lot of really intricate lines, really beautiful player. Wide receiver Bill Caballero, he's their principal horn. So they've got some real star talent this year. I think they could go all the way.
You were so prepared for that question. Thank you so much.
I would
put some money on that lineup. We also have Lauren Gershman here in the studio. She's a Pittsburgh-based sports reporter for Penn Live. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, a new podcast explores Philadelphia public schools through the eyes of one single mother. That's next. Stay with us when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Comcast just tapped Pittsburgh for a new program that'll boost connectivity among the Internet of Things, aka devices like your smart TV and Amazon Echo. Some startups are using the platform to make devices that collect data on bridge safety and potholes. And Jerry Weber of Jerry's Records in Squirrel Hill is retiring this weekend. He's handing the business over after 42 years. Find more top news at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Virginia Elvino-Young in for Kevin Gavin. An education is seen as a pathway out of poverty and key to success for lots of folks. But for single teen moms, graduating high school can feel like a long shot. And statistically, it is. A new limited-run podcast, Schooled, examines public education through lots of perspectives, the first season focusing on one very special student. Let's talk about it now with host Kevin McCory, reporter for the multi-station project Keystone Crossroads. He's based at WHYY out in Philadelphia. Thanks so much for making the time, Kevin.
Great to be here, Virginia. Thanks.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag. We'd love to hear from you. That hashtag is WESAConfluence. Kevin, your podcast centers around a central character, Savannah Zayas, who you just happened to encounter at a public hearing where she was testifying. What drew you to her and her story?
When I first heard her testify, I mean, she just blew me away with her maturity and her ability to really put her thoughts and feelings into words. I mean, I interview high school students, students in general for my job all the time as an education reporter, and she just stood out right away as someone who you could tell not only lived a very difficult life and that a lot of students in our challenged public school system live, but she was able to put voice to those thoughts and feelings in a way that is very unique. And then the more I talked to her, the more I wanted to keep talking to her. And it just, you know, morphed into this longer project to the point that it became this three-part podcast.
Yeah. I mean, what was it about her personal circumstances that you felt were reflective of a sort of broader group of young people in Philadelphia?
Well, I would say it's more than just Philadelphia. You know, it's challenged school districts across the state and across the country. You know, are serving districts that have very high concentrations of students who are living in poverty, who have known immense trauma, and that makes the job of educators that much harder. And that's often a point that is hard to kind of get at in a lot of the reporting that I do, which is policy and politics and, you know, state battles. And the idea behind this podcast was, let's see those issues through the eyes of students. Let's at least first understand what it actually means to be a student coming from this very difficult situation, going to this school, what it means then to be the school, to have to try to serve those students, the teacher, to try to have to serve those students. Let's just really get an intimate portrait of that life. And my hope was that, A, I just wanted to be informed myself. I mean, there's things that you can guess when you start to look at statistics and you look at, you know, the number of people who are in poverty or who have some sort of special need or who are involved in, you know, the welfare system or the Department of Human Services. You can guess what's in their lives. And, you know, we all have family members, or maybe we ourselves have been through things like this. But to really try to see it from a student's life in real time, as a person who has kind of all that content expertise in education, was really eye-opening for me, and I think made for some compelling storytelling that I hope gets more people interested in this idea of public education.
Certainly. Well, let's hear a little bit now from Schooled about what sort of environment Savannah was born into. We'll hear from her mom, Neverlyn, in the clip, followed by Savannah.
Savannah's mom, Neverlyn Vargas, was already 6 months along before she realized she was pregnant with Savannah. She was 16 years old, living not far from where the family lives today.
And then when I did find out, I didn't really want him. I wasn't just ready.
Neverlyn was addicted to PCP at the time and was actively hoping the drug would terminate the pregnancy.
So I figured that me keep smoking would end up killing her, but it didn't.
When Neverlyn's mom found out she was pregnant, she made her go to the doctor.
And when they did the ultrasound, they seen that the umbilical cord was wrapped around her neck. So I went in for an early C-section.
Savannah was born on January 17th, 1997, 2 months premature.
I've been a fighter since birth. I weigh like 4 pounds. What, 4 ounces?
4 pounds, 4 ounces.
And then the cycle continued, right? Savannah herself became pregnant at 14. She had been subjected to some horrific abuse, so she was really up against a lot. And we often hear in stories of folks who, you know, quote, made it, that there was one person in their life that made a difference. And that was no different for Savannah. She had some teachers here and there who were supporting her. But helping one kid at a time, is that what it's going to take, or is that even possible?
Yeah, I don't know if I have the answer for the system in general and what it takes to get everyone who's in Savannah's situation across the finish line or even just to graduation. But I think that, you know, a major theme of the story for me is that students coming from very difficult situations often don't have people in their home lives who they can really count on. And school is that consistent space for them, or at least it can be. And so in Savannah's experience, there were, like you said, a couple teachers along the way who really were tremendously impactful on her life. And, you know, for a host of reasons, the one had to leave or decided to leave the high school that she was attending. And that really kind of put her into a tailspin in her academics and in her personal life. And I think it's just realizing that, you know, the adults in schools really mean a lot to students, and the quality of them as educators and as instructional leaders and as, you know, transmitters of academic knowledge is one tremendous piece of it. But the other tremendous piece is really just having somebody in your life who you know cares for you, who is there for you. And it's almost like the Maslow hierarchy, right? You know, you have to have all that emotional stuff kind of in place before you can really start learning. And if you're not getting it at home, then it's really up to the teacher, unfortunately, but that's just the reality of it, to take care of that before they can get students into the subject matter. And for someone like Savannah, I think that's exactly what happened. And she's a you know, a vivacious student. She wants to learn. She's hungry to learn for education. But even her, like, you know, she needs to know that the teachers that she has or had care for her and are there for her and are willing to listen to her. That just means so much to people in her position.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Kevin McCorry, in episode 2 of School, Savannah talks about some of her struggles within the high school. And during her junior year, there was a lot of teacher burnout and turnover, and the district hadn't really adequately staffed replacements. That meant a lot of class time, not enough supervision. Let's hear a little bit of what that was like for Savannah.
That fight went on for 3 minutes, and no adults was around. And it was two boys, and I don't know what they were fighting about, but...
just fists and
like
hitting and...
pounding in the face at each other, blood, like, bad. That gets me frustrated because it just makes me feel like, why do I need to try so hard when I feel like everything else is like falling apart?
Are the problems we saw at Edison High School in this podcast problems that we're seeing throughout the Philadelphia region and across the state?
I think that you've certainly have a situation in Pennsylvania where when you look at the need in the most challenged schools, the schools that are serving the quote unquote most difficult to serve students, you often find that the resources needed to meet those needs are not really commensurate to that need. And so, you know, it does mean that there's not enough faculty members. Maybe it means that, you know, people get burned out over time, and so there's this turnover and churn, and that, you know, creates instability for the kids who need stability the most. So I don't think it's unique to Edison High School. I don't think it's unique to Philadelphia. I think it is truly, I don't think it's unique to urban education. I think that when you have schools that serve a large amount of students who have known poverty, have known trauma, and you try to, you know, bring them up to state standards and academic standards, but you don't necessarily match resources to that need, you're going to have problems. And you know, I talk about need and resources, and, you know, the state of Pennsylvania has this new school funding formula, for instance, right? And it kind of lays out exactly, look, based on this factor, based on poverty, based on this, based on that, based on this, this is what this school district should get as far. This is how this school district should be prioritized when it comes to funding. Unfortunately, at this point, you know, about 7% of the money that the state gives out goes through that formula. So for those school districts that face those gigantic needs, you can kind of see clearly in black and white, well, even the state's formula says, you know, you should be up here. But in reality, based on a lot of, you know, political realities, honestly, that's just not going to happen because there's only, you know, limited resources. And to give more to, you know, inner city Philadelphia or York or Reading or, you know, a district around Pittsburgh, you would have to take away from another district, which, you know, they're certainly relying on those resources as well.
In terms of teasing apart that the state lacks an equitable funding system, is that something that you'll be exploring in future episodes, future seasons of the podcast?
Well, you know, I think my more day-to-day, week-to-week reporting often goes into those issues. You know, I do a lot of deep kind of policy dives and get into all that. So, you know, you can follow the Keystone Crossroads Education reporting, I think, to get into that. The idea of these podcasts is more to ground listeners into narrative stories, right? And so that if you're spurred to care a little bit more about education, you can find the reporting. But, you know, I didn't want to interrupt Savannah's story too much with a policy conversation or a debate about funding. I wanted, you know, it to be her story. I'll give you some context here and there. And then, you know, based on, again, you know, caring about her or understanding a little bit more about what it actually means to be a student in her situation, you know, maybe then you'll care a little bit more about the policy conversation that otherwise might just, you know, you kind of roll your eyes at and, you know, it's a little dry, right? So the idea is the more you care about, you know, the human aspect of it, the more you'll care about the policy.
Kevin McCorry is a reporter covering education for Keystone Crossroads and the host of the new podcast, Schooled, that's available now. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Coming up, opioid overdoses. First responders across southwestern PA have found themselves ill-equipped to handle the storm of emergencies caused by heroin and narcotics. Two photojournalists take us behind the lens for a glimpse of what it's like to document this growing epidemic. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, political activist Alexander Berkman attempts to assassinate industrialist Henry Clay Frick in 1892. Berkman was an anarchist leader who came to Pittsburgh after Frick broke up the homestead strike to show his support for the union workers. He didn't succeed and spent 14 years in jail, but the organized labor movement gained significant ground in Pittsburgh and around the country. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for July 28, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Virginia Elvino-Young in this week for Kevin Gavin. Emergency responders who respond to overdose calls often use the overdose reversal drug Narcan. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Let's talk now with some folks working to create images to help us visualize an epidemic that's prevalent but may only be seen by those who are touched firsthand by opioids. Joining us in the studio is Andrew Russell, longtime photojournalist for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Thanks for being here, Andrew.
Oh, thank you.
We also have freelance photojournalist and writer Marini Ray-Staub, whose latest work on opioids was featured in Public Source. Marini, great to have you.
Thanks, Virginia.
If you have a question or a comment, we'd love to have you join in on the conversation as well. You can tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Andrew, many of your photos documenting the opioid crisis for the Trib published earlier this year. Marini, your work appeared online for Public Source in June. Tell us a little bit about these projects. Marini, let's start with you. How did you decide how you wanted to tell this story?
You know what? I went to Uniontown initially to, in an attempt to see the opioid epidemic through the eyes of emergency responders. And the more time I spent there, the more I realized that there was more of a story there than just the their response to what was going on in regards to opioids. I started to focus more on the people behind the characters there, their daily life, what it was like to work 24-hour shifts, the ups and downs, the roller coaster rides, the quiet moments, as well as the moments where they are providing life-saving care. So I guess the more time I spent there, the story started to take shape itself, sort of developed itself.
And Andrew, your work?
Yeah, we actually initially started with a very similar project to Marini's. We went down to the Washington County Ambulance Company and spent probably 4 or 5 nights there until one Friday night they got a call for an overdose. And when we arrived at the scene, there was an active overdose happening.
Was that surprising to you? What was your initial response? Is that what you expected to be encountering?
We knew there was an overdose call, but I think, you know, as a photojournalist, you spend a lot of time documenting some pretty grim situations, but this is one of the few times where I actually arrived at a true life or death situation.
Right. First responders in Pennsylvania use naloxone to block the effects of opioids on the brain and to restore breathing within 2 to 8 minutes. That's a very critical time. Did either of you know, you may have known that on paper, but did either of you know what to expect from overdose situations that you were encountering, what it was really like?
I knew the science behind it, but I didn't realize when Narcan is administered, the victim goes into immediate withdrawal, and the symptoms of withdrawal sort of, you know, collapse on them all of a sudden. So I didn't expect the nausea, the vomiting, the shaking. The victim here actually went right into a withdrawal symptoms immediately, and that was really surprising.
Both photo series required really an enormous amount of access to your subjects. These were very intimate settings. That you were at the firehouse, Marigny, and Uniontown, but often you were both on the scenes of really emergency situations, and you're there in a reporting capacity. How easy was it for you both to find subjects, both first responders and survivors, that were willing to let you and your lens into these moments?
You know what? I found both Jim and Alex to be really receptive to my presence. I think there was some apprehension initially, but after spending a couple hours with the guys, I found them to be warm and welcoming. They immediately gave me a tour of the facilities.
And who were Jim and Alex?
Jim and Alex are the two paramedics that mm-hmm. I ended up shadowing for the majority of my time there, for the four or five visits I spent out there. And at one point, Chief Buck, who was the chief of the firehouse, you know, I was thanking him for allowing me to be there and allowing me to spend 12 plus hours with them on these shifts. And he just looked at me and he said, you know what? Real people are always welcome here. And that kind of gave me insight into how they operated. They were very open people, and wanted I think they wanted their stories told. They wanted people to better understand what it was like to, be the first responders, whether it was medical or fire, in these towns.
And in terms of emergency situations, were they few and far between? Did you have long stretches of little to no activity, or how easy was it for you to be encountering people who needed assistance?
So I went out there five separate times for 10 hours, give or take, for each of these times. And some of those visits, we would end up talking for a few hours. And this is where, since I wrote and photographed, a lot of this is where I did some interviews. And then there were several hours where we were nonstop, and it was really just the ebb and the flow. And that was interesting for me to see just how it can go from crazy busy with all sorts of things, whether it's a grandmother or someone old that has fallen and couldn't get up, to some, you know, very life or death situation with an infant, to an overdose or whatever it might be, to, you know, these quiet periods. And they pointed out something that I found to be pretty interesting, that there was a correlation between the weather and certain types of emergency situations.
Hmm. What was that correlation?
They said that whenever the weather got nicer, things like became more active. They would get more calls.
Wow. Yeah. Did they have any idea why that was? It was just linked to people's recreational use?
I think so. People just getting out and being more active. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And Andrew, for your work, what was it like to try to gain access? Was there any pushback or challenges there?
I think what we experienced was that most of the first responders that we talked to and spent time with were very shy about the attention themselves. But I think everyone in that community and who works as a first responder recognizes just the dire situation that this opioid epidemic has kind of led us to. And I think that in their minds superseded their shyness, as it were.
Tell us a little bit about the community that you were in, that you profiled in your work.
We were down in Washington, the Washington Ambulance and Chair Company, basically they staff it 24 hours, usually I think 2 to 3 in the night shift, and we would come down usually around 7 or 8 and spend mm-hmm. Around 8 to 10 hours with them, and then so we spent a lot of time just hanging out in the ambulance bay, talking, getting to know them, and occasionally a call would come in and we would head out with them.
The work featured survivors as well. Did the stigma around addiction play a role in the access that you were able to get with those folks?
Yeah, absolutely. Going into it, one of the biggest priorities for me was to make sure that anyone that we photographed who was a victim of overdose was would remain anonymous. So we tried not to show anything that would be distinguishing, any kind of distinguishing characteristics. I mean, unfortunately, addiction is still very, very stigmatized in our culture. And so we really made an effort to hide the identity of the the people we photograph.
Yeah, Marini and Andrew, I mean, you're doing all of this work to really expose what it's really like behind the opioid epidemic, and yet we do see this stigma prevailing. Is it changing at all? Is it getting better or worse as maybe the epidemic is getting closer to more people's lives and they understand the sort of human side of it?
I mean, I'd like to think that it is getting better, but I think that it really underlines the importance of what we and a lot of others are doing, including people that are experiencing addiction themselves or have friends or family. Just making it okay to talk about is, I think, becoming aware of something and then being willing and able to have those conversations is really the first step, I think, in addressing a problem such as this.
Well, you folks were really on the ground with this. Andrew, you, again, actually witnessed an overdose. Tell us about that moment. You described what happened, but how did you manage? How did you decide what to photograph, what to let pass? What was going through your mind in that situation?
Well, walking into the situation was absolutely terrifying. I think the reality of the situation hit me almost immediately. The woman's family was panicked, and I gotta give credit to the first responders. They were 100% professional, and their calm was almost infectious.
Right.
As soon as they walked in, the family calmed down, and if you kind of took your cues from them, they were completely contained and completely relaxed. They did their job, and it made it much easier to have confidence that this particular situation was going to turn out with a happy ending, and thankfully it did.
And is that just by virtue of your work as a photojournalist that you were able to sort of not only maintain your own composure, but judge objectively and visually what it was that you wanted to portray from the situation?
Maybe. I also think that the situation where the adrenaline was so kind of high that I think it was just in my the thing at the forefront of my mind was just to focus and to tell this story in the best way that I possibly could.
Let's talk about the photos themselves, right? So our listeners can see your photos on both triblive.com and publicsource.org. Can you, Marini, let's start with you, describe the photos that folks can see, the aesthetic of them, and what they really portray about the opioid epidemic.
So if people were... I didn't actually see an overdose.
Right.
So a lot of what people will see is more about the daily life, the 24/7, the TikTok of what it is like to be either a medical responder or a firefighter within this particular town. If they read the piece, though, I wrote a lot about the discussion surrounding Narcan, which is more of a debate within the firehouse, as well as the statistics that are I guess, that exists within Fayette County, but are really testament to those of Pennsylvania more widely.
I think one of the surprises when I was looking at the photos, and you mentioned this, the guys are really young. These are young guys that are working and obviously having very personal and emotional responses to some of the conversations that they're having in the firehouse.
So I walked away from this experience with more respect than I mean, I already had a lot of respect for emergency first responders, but Jim and Alex are both in their 20s and both have the maturity and the skill sets of someone that I would just have assumed would be much older. They both, sort of like Andrew said, they walk into these situations where the actions, they are 100% responsible for what is going to happen within that situation, and they would take complete control of the situation and administer life-saving care. And it was astounding to see. It really was.
Yeah, you spent a good amount of time there. I understand they had a nickname for you as well while you were there.
Well, I will always came right before or right after something terrible happened,
right,
which is it's a weird thing to say, but I had gone initially to see to see action,
right,
to see an overdose like Andrew did, and I had always just missed it. So they would call me their good luck charm, for better or worse. I'm kind of glad in the sense that it forced me to tell a different type of story, a more nuanced one about the people behind. You know, we I won't generalize, but sometimes I think that we don't give enough thought to, if we have an emergency, we call 911. Who are the people responding to it?
Right.
What are their lives like? What is the 24/7 of their existence and of their jobs? So.
And Andrew, for you, again, that other side of the story, you actually did witness that overdose. For folks who haven't seen the photos, tell us a little bit about what they depict.
The woman who's in the photos was talking to her daughter on the phone, around 7 o'clock, and she just suddenly quit talking. Her daughter, who was aware of her mom's addiction, immediately thought, "Oh my God, she's overdosed," and called called 911. Mm-hmm. They dispatched first responders, and we followed along behind them. And when we walked in, she was laying on the floor next to her bed, and there was a spoon and a needle and an empty stamp bag next to her bed, and she was splayed out and barely breathing. And the two first responders on the scene immediately snapped into action and went through the process that they do every time there's an overdose. They administered Narcan, and when she was revived, they loaded her onto an ambulance and took her to the hospital.
As you mentioned earlier, that it was a successful administering of Narcan, of the drug, and you later spoke with the survivor herself. Was there anything about her story, her illness, that she wanted people to know about?
Yeah, initially, after the incident itself, we made probably 4 or 5 trips down to her house. Mm. Just to check on her and see how she was doing, and also to talk to her to get her story. And there was at first she was really reluctant. There was so much shame involved with this. But once we sort of promised her anonymity, she opened up that she was a nursing assistant. She's been around addiction,
yeah.
And she tore some muscles in her back and began to take Percocets. Prescribed by her doctor, and it's just a common
right. That classic story of
yeah.
how things escalate.
Yeah, it really was exactly like every other story that you seem to hear with
yeah.
this. What she wanted to tell people was that that she recognizes that she had an addiction, and when we talked to her, she had been clean for a month. That overdose actually kind of snapped her into action to get clean and to deal with her addiction.
Well, with just about 1 minute left, I'd love to ask both of you, having looked at both sides of the situation, is there any sort of one thing that folks are in agreement about that needs to happen in order to address the problem with opioids? It's a tough one.
Yeah.
Yeah, there might not be one single answer.
I mean, I would personally say that the destigmatization of it is huge. It has to be okay to talk about an issue before we can address it. And I think that there is still a misperception of what an addict looks like. You know, it's not just whatever you might think. Many, many, many faces to addiction.
Right. Andrew?
Yeah, I would say that's the same thing. We got the same sense that this has to be destigmatized in order for us to go anywhere with it.
Andrew Russell is a photographer for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Marini Raystab is a freelance journalist whose piece on first responders in rural communities was featured in Public Source. Great work, both of you, and great to have you both on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistant and research from Katie Zielkowski. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Kevin Gavin will be back with us next week. Thanks for having me sit in your big chair this week. I'm Virginia Alvino Young. Until next time, hope you have a good week full of good news. Thanks so much.